Welcome to The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, Baseball Prospectus' local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes by searching for The Catbird Speaks, also on our Blog Talk Radio page or your favorite podcast app. I'm Colin Whitchurch, joined as always by Nick Schaefer. Hey, Nick.
Hello, everybody.
And we have a special guest today. You may know him from his work with Baseball Prospectus, with Vice Sports, FanRag Sports, or probably most commonly known as the guy making jokes on Twitter. It's Answer Dave, Dave Brown. Hey, Dave, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Colin and Nick. Thanks for asking me to come on. I only wish that the guy making jokes on Twitter was a paying gig.
Well, if you keep it up, you might get asked to promote next year's Fire Festival, maybe. So, you know.
I've been trying to hold off, like, looking into exactly what that was, other than some sort of music fiasco with Ja Rule in the middle of it. So I don't know too many details, and I'm trying to stay away so I don't have to know about it. But it's because, you know, I don't like to be that trendy. But anyway, yeah, maybe that'll work out.
Nice. Yeah, you can always maybe wait like 3 years and then bring it back once it's just the right amount of like not topical. It turns out that Dave, we were talking a little bit before we started recording. You were saying that you are also like us, you were a White Sox fan originally, and you are no longer located in the Chicago area.
Right. Although the way you put it, it makes it sound like the White Sox drove me from Chicago, which
well,
you know, hey, maybe that was part of it after all, subconsciously. But yeah, I grew up a White Sox fan. It was my mom and I. My dad died when I was little, and my mom was a big White Sox fan because her first baseball game was Game 1 of the 59 World Series when she was 9 years old. My grandfather took her to that game. He was in the media. He worked for AP as a photographer and a wire operator and, you know, knew somebody and got tickets to the series. And I think she's always been kind of a sports fan, but that was really her first, you know, in-person experience. And it was a, you know, they won 11-0, and it was kind of everything. It was perfect for her, and she just became a big White Sox fan and passed it on to me. And we had season tickets growing up, and this would be like, I think our first year for season tickets was the year that La Russa became the manager, to give you an idea of when this was, 79. So, and you know, we had them up until I kind of became a sports writer and got to go to the games and get paid for it. And at that point, she was tired of giving Reinsdorf money, blaming him for the 94 strike and all that. So, but she certainly was a loyal, you know, I grew up in Mount Prospect, so it wasn't exactly easy or quick to get to Sox Park. So, you know, she basically watched more on TV in her later years. And, but yeah, so that's like my early intro to the White Sox was, you know, when Harold Baines was coming up and Lamar Hoyt was just coming up and Britt Burns and those kind of guys, Chet Lemon. So that was my first White Sox introduction.
That's a good group. You know, my dad was actually at that game 1 in 59 as well. He would have been older than your mom, but yeah, I mean, I feel like obviously the rest of the series didn't go great, but that has to be like game 1 of the 59 World Series has to be what, like a top 5 or 10 White Sox game ever, right? To go to?
Yeah, I was just thinking about this from a different perspective. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get a hold of him, but I was trying to go through the White Sox to get Paul Konerko for the story I'm doing on Matt Davidson. And I was thinking about his grand slam in, I guess that would be game 1 of the World Series. And that's my favorite White Sox moment of all time. And I think in a lot of ways, the most important one, you know, even more so than the last out of 05. And I was trying to think of, you know, what are the greatest moments in White Sox history? And I think certainly, or games anyway, and you know, that World Series game obviously would be one, and the game 1 of the 59 World Series. And, you know, it was just, This is kind of a tease, though. It's sort of perfect because game one of the 59 World Series, they win 11-0. And, you know, I know they did score the rest of the series, but it seemed like, looking through the box scores and watching the film, like, you know, typical White Sox, the playoffs come and they don't hit. So just like 93 and 83 and 2000. So, what a way to grab hold of people. And, I'm sure that. You know, even if they maybe hadn't had a great game that day, she'd still be a White Sox fan. But what a wonderful tease to attract the young ball fans like that, just blowing out the Dodgers. But
yeah, you
know, like we said, the rest of the series didn't go great. So
sure, I guess there is that element too, where in terms of the Canerico Grand Slam in Game One, where obviously they'd been on such a run to that point, and I feel like what can happen sometimes in the playoffs is, you know, you get it's kind of whoever gets hot and you kind of see how long it'll carry and whether it'll carry all the way through. Cause sometimes you get, you know, I think like the 2007 Rockies where they won something like 21 out of 22 games. Then they like blitzed through the playoffs and then they just ran into a brick wall in the World Series in the Red Sox. Whereas, so that game one was kind of like, so new series, is this going to continue or is this where the ride comes to an end?
Right. You know, in retrospect, I'm old enough to remember the 85 Bears, and if they had not won the Super Bowl, I don't know what would have happened to Chicago. I mean, it was a fait accompli that it was going to happen. There was no, there wasn't, for the drought of championships and all that, in my impression of, as a 13-year-old was that, this is going to happen, and it's just a matter of how and how entertaining and how big and how much destruction the defense is going to put out. And, you know, that White Sox team in 05, it's funny how, you know, all the starters finished the games in the World Series, and, you know, it seems like baseball is like 180 degrees different of a game now just that it was 12 years ago. And but, like, you think back to that run and – they pretty much handled the Red Sox, but that series sort of turned on the Graffinino error before Aguchi's home run and, El Duque pitching out of a jam in Fenway. And of course, the ALCS, it looked like maybe the Sox were going to get down 0-2 to the Angels, I believe. And then A.J. Stole first base. You know, he bluffed his way to first base and sort of turned that series around. So as much as it seems like things were meant to be. And, there's just those little moments along the way where you never know where things are going to turn. I guess that's the great thing about sports. You know, we sort of plan ahead and play everything out on paper and guess where things are going to go. And then, the guys surprise us anyway. That's the great thing about it.
It's funny, like, and You kind of get that this year with the Cubs, too, where, I mean, I was 18 when the White Sox won the 05 World Series, and I remember, it completely changing your mindset as a fan where, you know, 06 came around and the team still won 90-something games and they were chasing Detroit the entire way, and I remember just the entire time in August, September, they're sitting like 6-7 games out, and I never, even at like as a 19-year-old, thinking, well, they're going to catch Detroit eventually, obviously, because everything broke so perfectly in 05. And it's funny how you can do a complete 180 on that, where you go 80, 90 years, 100 years without winning a World Series to you found some success, and now you expect that success.
Right. Yeah, it really does change your mind. I was having I'm based out of Kansas City now. I think we mentioned earlier in the – have been for like 5 years, if we didn't mention it. I'm based out of Kansas City now. and I was at a couple games of the White Sox series in May, for those of you listening, like 10 years in the future, in early May. and Paul Sullivan of the Tribune, I've been – at least good friends, but certainly really good acquaintance of his for 15 years. And, he grew up a Chicago sports fan and a guy going to Wrigley Field and Cubs games and sitting in the bleachers. And he's like, now that the Cubs won the World Series, it's like I don't know what to do with myself. You know, as a fan, as a person with a life force, you know, I don't have any, I don't have this angst, this whatever hanging over me anymore because the Cubs have completely flipped the script. You know, they're not the lovable losers. He didn't use that phrase, but just that's a phrase that people use have used for them, of course. And the whole identity of being a Cubs fan is different now. Now they're, I mean, whatever happens, you know, whether they turn into a dynasty or, you know, they win 3 years out of six like the Giants or whatever, or they don't win again for 108 years, and that's certainly, I mean, it could happen. It's totally different. It's just it's amazing what sports does to your psyche and your you know we all have jobs and you know have. We do have families or are going to have families or whatever, and all that stuff is important, but it's almost like your mood and your entire world outlook hangs on, you know, how the White Sox are doing or the Cubs or the Bears. It's just – it's strange that that sort of is the thing that guides you and is your compass. And maybe I'm not speaking for everybody, but that, I mean that's that's sort of how it was for me. I remember – again, going back to those Bears teams, you know, when they lost to Miami or that next year when they would lose a couple games, you know, that would kind of ruin your week and just until the next game. And I don't necessarily feel that way about, you know, 100% about sports. But, you know, when the White Sox are going well, you know, I feel better about life in general. I, you know, there's a little more optimism. And so that's sort of what's nice about them. You know, unexpectedly getting off to a pretty good start this year. It's even though we all know what the plan is and or we think we have a general idea of what the White Sox are trying to do in rebuilding, it's just nice to have them unexpectedly being playing well. And it's one less thing to be cynical about, I guess.
Well, that's a funny thing about like Paul Sullivan being Inigo Montoya after successfully avenging his father's death and not knowing what to do. He's been in the revenge business for so long.
Yes.
I guess the Cubs need to figure out whether they're going to be Dread Pirate Roberts now or whatever it is. But even now, coming up on my 30th birthday as opposed to when I was, I don't know, 11, I definitely have a lot more perspective about what and distance about White Sox wins and losses. But it does. Even just on a day where they win, I just, you know, it cheers me up a little bit. It makes me more, you know, I want to go back and watch the highlights again a little bit more. And
yeah.
But what's been cool about this start is, you know, obviously Quintana, and as we speak, Quintana just gave up a couple runs in the first. Part of that seems to have been an infield single from Mark Trumbo. So that seems to be how his year is going.
But the
fact that you've got some guys who I think – people were getting ready to sort of, you know, myself included, to write, look like they were going to be written out of the future of the team, are now emerging to look like they might be good complementary parts for the new core of stars they're trying to assemble. Because, you know, you have Avisail Garcia is obviously off to his best start, and Lurie Garcia went from sort of an afterthought to looking like, hey, maybe this is a guy who's going to be a second division starter in center field or a good utility player. And you know, you mentioned that you're working on something on Davidson as well, and Davidson's a guy who's looking like, hey, this could be a – he could be a useful corner infield, maybe even – I don't know if he's fleet of foot enough to do corner outfield kind of guy. But there's these interesting complementary parts sort of emerging, which regardless of wins and losses is really fun to see.
Well, and it does change your perspective a little bit. Even I caught myself thinking Quintana pitched one of the games that I went to, and I'm like, well, do they have to trade him? And, you know, is the market for pitchers going to be so saturated that, you know, seeing that the White Sox do a little better here and putting everything into context, like you know, is the trade market for starting pitching at the 2017 deadline, is it going to be saturated to the point where you're not really going to get a great return? You know, if the White Sox have these parts, you know, and if Moncada comes up and is really good, and Dane Dunning, well, Dane Dunning's probably far away, but you know, do you give a long-term extension to Quintana? You know, and I think about White Sox history and long-term contracts, and they don't, you know, they don't usually do it. They usually get rid of the pitcher, and it's usually the right thing that they did. So, but still, it's like, you know, if Quintana could do this for 5 or 6 more years, then maybe, you know, he would be a great Burley-esque, you know, ace for when the next time the White Sox are good. So, you know, Rick Hahn has said somebody, I think the Score interviewed Rick Hahn and asked him about this and said, you know what, we still, no matter how it's great that they've gotten off to the start, but no matter what the wins and, you know, the plan is still what it was, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago. So, you know, I think it's, but it just, it gives, you know, it's less of a fatalistic thing that, you know, oh, they're definitely going to trade Quintana. You know, maybe they won't now, but you know, they probably will. It's just, the team's just more interesting when they win. It's just, there's more stuff going on.
And I feel like there's this sense, and this kind of dovetails back with what we were talking about, perceptions of an organization or your outlook on the world / your team. I feel like there are times where organizations seem to just have everything figured out. And if a team makes a certain move, you assume that, you know, it's probably going to work out as opposed to not, just because their evaluation's so good, or they've just got their, I don't know, their internal metrics figured out, or maybe they're just lucky. But, you know, for a while it felt like, for example, the Cardinals, if they added, when they signed Holiday for 7 years, it's like, well, it's the Cardinals, so that's probably going to work out. And then it did. Whereas if the White Sox signed certainly a position player or traded for a position player for forever, it felt like this just isn't going to work out. You know, even when you add, if you trade a reliever for a top 100 prospect bat, like you did with Addison Reed and Matt Davidson, it's like, well, geez, you know, this is how most teams do this, and most teams it would work out, and the White Sox it like really looked like it wouldn't. I don't know if they've started turning a corner where they're starting to be able to actually fix some of the problems where if you have a talented but imperfect young player, certainly on the position player side, where maybe they can actually help smooth out those wrinkles and actually get something out of them now, because it's been a long time since they've been able to do that.
Right. And you guys probably are a little closer to knowing the answer to this than I am. But, you know, they've traded for all these minor league prospects and so forth. Are they getting better at finding them on their own and drafting them and bringing them in themselves so they don't have to give up assets to get them? Did they make changes with scouting or what have they done in the last couple of years here to sort of make it so they're not so empty?
Yeah, I don't know if I know they've made changes on the scouting department. They have found, I feel like, some, I guess, depending on your definition of success, I don't know if they've found any, like, stars necessarily through their system, but they've slowly started to develop some role players. I mean, Tyler Saladino has proved to be a competent major leaguer, and depending on what happens with Tim Anderson, he could obviously end up being the biggest outlier that the system produces, at least from the positional standpoint. And then, yeah. I mean, you talk about guys like Davidson, like Avisail, like Lurie. You know, if they can just produce, I mean, guys who are just competent major leaguers, not necessarily stars, that's already a step in the right direction.
I think also, you know, obviously the draft system changing to the hard slotting benefited the White Sox because they were the one team that was really refusing to spend out of the soft slots, which put them at a disadvantage regardless of their scouting. I think that, you know, to add guys that they drafted who are no longer with the organization, Marcus Semien's a guy that they found late who obviously looks like he's going to be a solid major leaguer. And then you have, I know that like last year's draft, if you look at their third and fourth round picks, they grabbed, or maybe this was the year before. Now I'm blanking, but somebody joked that the White Sox had basically sorted by on base percentage from college players when they drafted like Alex Call and Jameson Fisher.
Yeah,
where it's like these are just these are like college performers with probably low ceilings, but you know sometimes those guys, if they have a high floor, all it takes is one tool developing a little bit further, and all of a sudden their profile looks a lot better. I know Jared Seidler from our prospect team talks about that. And I think Wade for the Yankees is like an example he gives for that, where it's like, oh, this guy looks like a nondescript, decent middle infielder. And if he all of a sudden looks a little bit better, maybe he looks a little bit better defensively at short, all of a sudden that his profile changes significantly. So they might find more of those guys, because I don't think they really have in a long time, except for Semien, who they traded away. So, right. There's hope there. I think they've learned from some of their mistakes in years past. They're definitely not really they're hoarding picks. I mean, they instead of signing a free agent in the heading into the 2016 season, they hung on to their pick to grab Birdie as well. So could be more coming internally in the future, I would hope. And you know, they've got the new manager. I don't know if I think you mentioned you got to you were with the team, was it last week?
Yeah, whenever they played the Royals, so it would be was it the beginning of last week, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you noticed anything about the atmosphere around the team. Maybe, you know, the expectations are different, but you know, with Renteria in charge versus Ventura or anything else like that.
Yeah. Well, a few things that I talked to Abreu and Davidson, and those are the two guys that are coming to mind, asking them like what Renteria is like as a manager, and what are the attributes that you look for in a good manager. Obviously, players, you know, don't usually choose their managers, but if they had their druthers. And I remember Davidson saying the first thing is positivity. That, you know, I think, you know, we look at what the expectations were for the White Sox coming in. And I don't think Renteria took them to camp with the, you know, under the motto, something like, you know, well, you know, we obviously we're selling for the future and the heck with this year. I mean, he wanted to kind of start fresh after Robin. You know, he was the bench coach last year, so they knew him. The relationship is a little different, but I think they see a guy who is positive, one, and Davidson talked about that. Actually, and Abreu talked about how he's not a micromanager, but he's a guy who will get into little details. He's got a lot of different little skills from different aspects of the game, and he will you know, talk to a guy about his swing, or he will you know, give him a little pep talk about how he's been, you know, hitting the ball well, or how he's playing defense, and maybe a tip here or there. And Davidson said there's a fine line between a manager who is, you know, sort of overbearing and one who is involved and engaged and able and, you know, has credibility to talk about little details, aspects of the game, to where, you know, players, they get all sorts of things go through their head, and they're really good at forgetting about failure. And, you know, baseball is one of those games where, you know, everybody knows you fail 7 times out of 10 and so forth. But also things that help you along the way kind of get lost. And it's almost like the best coach is one who will help you remember those things that you already know. And I think it's Davidson's impression and Abreu's impression that Renteria is a guy that's good at that. And, you know, if you can be technically a good manager and know some things about how to help players get out of slumps or get through the dog days and help them just be positive in general, and someone who is, you know, not going to make horrendous lineup decisions. You know, a lot of people complain about Cody Ashe, but I think there's playing a lot, but there's obviously more going on there. The White Sox are trying to just make sure that he's, you know, they brought him with, so I guess they're going to make sure if he's good or not. And so, you know, if this were September, I don't think Rick Renteria would necessarily be playing Cody Ashe anymore, but I don't know. But I kind of got off my point. But if those are a couple things, you know, if you want to look for good signs for the future for Renteria being manager of the White Sox, I think it's those things, that he's a positive guy, and I think they need that. You know, the Royals, Ned Yost is incredibly positive with his players, and that's you can't minimize that over the course of these really long seasons. And two, you know, technically he's got some chops as far as knowing how to answer questions or giving good little piece of advice or being a good reminder of things that maybe the player had forgotten or had slipped his mind. So I think those are two really good indicators that maybe he's a good manager.
It is interesting. Obviously Renteria seems to have a reputation for being good with youngsters. You know, that's why he was brought into the Cubs, and that tenure obviously lasted shorter because of Joe Maddon's availability. But I remember, and I was interested in your answer there, Dave, because we're always trying to quantify, you know, managers' worth, and it's so difficult to do because there's only so much when the game begins that they can control, right, whether it be the makeup of the lineup or bullpen decisions, et cetera. The thing that struck me the most, I spent a couple days in Arizona with them back in March, was everyone talked about how comfortable he makes the youngsters. You know, I spoke with Lucas Giolito about that. I spoke with Zach Collins about that, and they said that there's no necessarily divide in the clubhouse between, well, here are our veterans and here are our youngsters. And I feel like he has the right players to do that, because Todd Frazier's always talking to everyone, and he's like seems like the most friendly guy in the world. And, you know, Jose Abreu's locker was right next to Moncada's at spring training. So there was this interesting mix of veterans and youngsters, and everyone just felt comfortable with each other. And I feel like those are the kind of things, and a lot of what you were talking about, that you can't really quantify, and you just got to kind of wait and see how they play out as to determine whether a manager's successful or not.
And it's struck – oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That reminds me, too, of – Jerry Manuel was a guy that Jonah Carey singled out for praise in his book about the Expos, which I definitely recommend reading, where especially with young hitters and telling them what they needed to hear and when, as a bench coach for them, or a bench coach or third base coach or whatever assistant role he had there. And he was definitely oversaw sort of the last era where the White Sox were developing bats, and they were frankly developing them like crazy. But, and you know, maybe Canerico would have turned out the way he did anyway, or maybe, Magaly Ordóñez and Carlos Lee were going to be great hitters no matter what. But I do wonder if, you know, because of how hard it is to quantify a manager, if we are going to learn that Ventura was struggling in ways that we couldn't even see, because it was obvious that the players liked him, or most of them seemed to, and it was obvious that he was a thoughtful, calm guy, but he was definitely overmatched in X's and O's. And, you know, to have a guy like Jimmy Rollins this spring go off on how terrible the White Sox clubhouse was last year, it was really jarring to hear that, because that was supposed to be Ventura's strength.
Right. And I didn't get a chance to, you know, in the Robin era, I didn't go to a lot of games, and, you know, so I'm stuck with watching them on TV and hearing stories and reading stories. So I'm definitely not an authority on what went on behind the scenes there. But, I think a little bit of Robin's problem was, you know, that they had some years where the talent level was really low, and there shouldn't really have been any expectations to do well. And so he wasn't necessarily given all the tools necessary. Although, you know, I think back to his first year, though, when they were in first place until late, and then they collapsed. And, you know, I don't know how much to put on Robin there, but, so much of this game is about confidence, and it's possible that Ventura just wasn't able to communicate in a way that made people confident. I mean, that was another thing that Davidson, when he's talking about stressing positivity, I think a guy can be like chipper all day long and whatnot, but it doesn't necessarily, communicate faith that he's, you know, the leader for you, or that he knows what he's talking about when it comes to if he says, hey, you know, you're doing a great job and I really like how you did that. I don't know that necessarily works. I think there has to be just an added dimension that, what he's telling you is not just what you want to hear. It's I don't know, constructive positivity. And maybe Ventura was different and he couldn't quite get that across. It's one of those things where, a player's confidence can be as good as they are at forgetting, the 0-for-3 from the day before. I still think that is one of the most, people talk about momentum in sports and in baseball, and I think you can scrap that word and replace it with confidence and things make a lot more sense. If you feel like you are going to get on a roll, there's maybe more of a chance that it actually happens when we're talking about players who are really talented in the first place, who have the talent to do it, but it's just a matter of not getting down on yourself when you're hitting the ball hard and it's not getting down for a base hit. It's just there's just a fine line sometimes, and I think at least early on, Renteria appears to be a guy that the players will take seriously when he says, you know what, it's going to be okay if things aren't going well. And we'll see how the White Sox do. You know, maybe they're entering one of those slumpy periods now. I don't know if they're what's going on against the Orioles today, but if they get swept, that would be, maybe the first down point of the season. I don't know, and we'll see how they respond to that. It's going to be interesting to find out exactly how they do, after one of those bad periods.
I think that credibility point is really interesting because, you have, a guy like Renteria has experience and had positive, evaluations as opposed to Ventura, who's coming in with none, just sort of the front office's confidence in him. And it's the difference, I guess, between, your mom telling you you're handsome versus, a stranger. It looks like Quintana, I've got game day up. It looks like he's just getting blooped and grounders or yes. Just every grounder's finding a hole. It does not look they're down 4-0 in the second and Quintana's getting ahead of every hitter, just giving up like bloopers. And it's one of those days. So of course his trade value's in the toilet, according to Twitter.
It swings every inning, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. When you have a guy with 800 straight innings of very established performance, what you have to do is look at every, BABIP driven early May start to determine whether he's any good or not.
And then make sure you tag teams in your tweets about them too. Tag the Astros and the Nationals and the Yankees.
Because they don't know what's going on unless someone tells them on Twitter.
Exactly.
I think if the three of us all at the Yankees, we can trick Brian Cashman into a totally different perception of Quintana.
Well, he runs that account.
He does.
That's what he's doing all day. It's tweeting. Aaron Judge puns.
Yeah, there was that big controversy when Hal Steinbrenner kicked Cashman off of the Twitter account so he could tweet, right? That was like a big thing.
So, yeah. It's and one more point about Ventura. One of you guys brought it up. I think I heard it. Just the coming in without a track record, and not only coming in without a track record, just having that experience. And Renteria seems more like a guy that's, you can just kind of mentally picture him with a fungo bat. And I know that in and of itself is not, whatever, is not important. But just, I don't know. He just seems like more of a guy that's on the field. And Ventura spent those years in the front office or whatever that was as a special advisor. And Renteria seems more like a guy who was sort of trained and ready to be a manager. And maybe if Ventura's experience as a manager had come at a different time when the White Sox had more talent, maybe things would be different. But Renteria seems like the guy for the job right now.
Yeah, I mean, Matheny and Osmus got away with it because they had better rosters in part. But because I think all three of those guys were signed the same year and they were all former players without any managerial experience.
And
but
Walt Weiss was the other one, right?
Right. That's
his experience. Walt Weiss was a high school coach.
Oh.
Before the Rockies, so.
I'm trying to remember who was. Jacob May was sent down, and it brought Willie Garcia back. So we have the triple Garcia situation. Just right now, it's May. It's May 7th. Which of these Garcias will be on the next White Sox playoff team, if any?
I've always had kind of a, not a hate, but I've always been suspicious of Avisail Garcia because I didn't think that, I thought it was great that he was hitting 300 in the minors as a 19-year-old, but I just looked at his strikeout to walk ratio and I'm just like, how is this going to work in the majors? Good. I guess up until now, that's sort of been the case, but I need to be reminded of his youth, generally speaking. And oh boy, I've been in the clubhouse before with him, but for some reason I was talking to somebody and he sort of came up behind and I'm like, oh my God, who's this giant man? And he's just enormous in person. And, you can see why you know, it's sort of like the old the Moneyball Billy Beane modeling genes thing. I mean, you can see why scouts would just kind of sort of like the hot girl just came into the room. I mean, he's just quite a specimen. Anyway, not to get off on a tangent, but I don't know that much of. I thought Lurie Garcia was maybe more of a utility-ish kind of guy, but you know, he's played well in center field, and I don't know that much about Willie. I don't, you know, he just got here, so you guys probably know a little bit more about him. And maybe you have different opinions of Abascal. I mean, I've been ready to trade or DFA Abascal here for a couple of years. So you know, shows you what I know. He's been really good. I don't know exactly how this is going to sustain and how good he's going to be. But, you know, and I'm not sure about his – what are the advanced stats of his defense in right field? I've always thought maybe he'd be better in left, even though he's got the arm. But I don't know. So I'd answer your question. Probably Lurie is going to be the guy, and Willie won't be very good, and Abascal will be on the Rockies.
I think Lurie is a good bet because he has, like, even if his bat goes into a slump, he has like these slump proof skills where, like, you know, if he's your 25th man on your roster, it still solves a lot of problems because he can play literally everywhere. And he can pinch run, and it looks like he can hit a little bit now too, which is great. In terms of Abascal's defense, I mean, being at Baseball Prospectus, it's really interesting because he, you know, the eye test, it's looked really bad for most of his career, and I think UZR has hated him, but FRAA hasn't minded him much at all. In fact, it's had him as like an above average defender for the last 3 years, this year included. I mean, it's also weird that a guy who's as gigantic as he is, like you said, like A, can't pull the ball unless it's like the worst slider ever, or B, like he gets so much of his batting average ability is beating out infield hits. Cause now that he's lost the weight from last year, he's like back to his 10%+ infield hit rate, which is crazy. But like, you see it, he does it all the freaking time. He's like really, I don't know if he's just like fast down the line or if fielders just look at him and think they have more time, but it's a big
I didn't have a stopwatch on him. I don't really own one, but I watched him. He beat out one or two grounders or almost did against the Royals. I'm like, man, he's really moving down the line. So at least to the eye test, he does get down the line fast. He hustles and he's, I think, naturally fast somehow for a person who is like the size of two people when you stand up next to him. But so, you know, he's just a pretty frustrating, you know, it's like it seemed like that was originally the guy they rebuild around was him.
Yeah.
To get that deal. So and it's just been a lot of empty stats so far. But I mean, you know, I think getting back to the question, I don't know much about Willie. Maybe Willie will be somehow some combination of the two. I don't know. It's, I kind of wish they had like four or five Cabreras on the team. I feel like Cabrera, those guys are better, a slightly higher class of ball player than the Garcias. I don't know. No, I'm speaking jokes, but.
It is funny you said that about Abascal though, because I always said the first time I was in the White Sox clubhouse last year, I remember commenting that if someone were to walk into this clubhouse and have no idea about the athletic prowess of any of these players, and you said, who's the best player on this team, they would point to Abascal.
Yes.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely. No question. It's like having your own Giancarlo Garcia. I just call him Giancarlo Garcia. Giancarlo Stanton. It's, I mean, he's, you know, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but you know, he's definitely the guy you go. Yes, that is a great way to put it. That you open the door and it's like, wow, there's the alpha male. He's right over there. He's
yeah,
Abascal Garcia.
I mean, you've got Willie Garcia. I don't know there was a game within the last week where he, I think, had huge throws. I don't remember if that was in KC or if that was Baltimore. So I don't know if you would have caught that, but I know when he came in. The White Sox have this like collection of dudes who are still, they're kind of like the descendants of the Diane Viciado tree, where it's like huge raw power, huge throwing arm, and it's not clear what else they can do. And Willie Garcia, I think, is kind of that category, but he can – they're working with him so that he can cover center sort of as like a, you know, once or twice a week type thing, not as a full-time gig, and he's obviously got a cannon. But I think coming into this season – Colin, if you remember any more detail about this, and this, I'm sure this is great radio, something I vaguely remember someone saying, is, you know, between him, between Willie Garcia, Avisail, and Reimer Liriano, it was like, you know, which of these guys, if you have to keep one of them to move forward, is worth, is most likely to pan out. And I think the answer was Reimer at the time, just because he had the best excuse for not performing yet. But you know, they have these guys, and I guess if they ever do put it together, you know, we're looking at it right now. When Avisail's going good, it looks great. But
yeah, I remember – I mean, Reimer, I feel like I remember he hit terribly in spring training. Didn't he hit like 120 or something like that?
In like a year because of his head injury.
The thing about Willie that's interesting is I remember and I'm far from a scout, you know, so my untrained eye watching out there, watching him play right field, I kept mistaking him for Avisail, and not just because they both had Garcia on the back of their jersey. He just kind of lumbered around and misplayed balls often. So the fact that – so obviously – I'm an idiot because now they're talking about him covering center field potentially, and maybe he, you know, obviously he's got a good arm, but if he can move around a little better, maybe I just caught him on a bad day or something, because he's so big, it's surprising that to think that he could potentially play center.
Yeah, I mean, he cut his strikeout to walk ratio way down at his second go around at third go around at AAA this year so far, so maybe that's a good sign. But in terms of another dude with big power where it's unclear where it's going to turn out, you talked to Davidson for a while, Dave, I think you mentioned. I don't know if you want to – I know you've got an article coming down on this, so I don't know if you want to hold back on some of that. But I don't know if you want to share any of your thoughts on Davidson or any impressions he made on you.
Yeah. No, I could talk about it. It's one of those things where you kind of mean to get something published and just – it doesn't necessarily happen as quickly as you want, but it should be out on Baseball Prospectus, if not tomorrow, the next day. So I talked to Davidson. I talked to Mike Gellinger, who was sort of like the first advanced stats guy for the White Sox. He's with the organization for like 16 years in a not quite a coach, but certainly a staffer and a helper and assistant in various capacities. He was on the staff when they won the World Series in 05. I guess his, you know, maybe late 90s or around 2000, and has done things like he's been rookie league manager and minor league infield instructor, and now he's the hitting coordinator in the minors. And 2 years ago when Davidson was coming off the two seasons where he hit 200 for 2 years in a row in AAA, he was basically desperate and out of options to try and help sustain his career. So he was talking to some guys on the team. I think he said he was talking to whoever the video coordinator was at the time and maybe another player who, you know, he was like, what can I do to not hit 200 anymore? And and they're like, maybe give Gellinger a call. He worked with Paul Konerko, and Konerko, of course, for all the love that he's gotten, you know, incredibly streaky hitter, or at least it seemed like he was, and a guy who would kind of suffer with his confidence sometimes and would admit to as much.
Well, he killed the 2003 team. It was his age 27 year, and it was like the worst year of his career.
Right. Was that – did he go to – was that the All-Star game and home run hitting contest year where he went in the toilet in the second half, or was that earlier than that?
No, I think 2003 was the year where he was just abysmal the entire season for like no discernible reason.
So, it happens to the best of us, I guess. And anyway, so yeah, the Konerko Gellinger side of the story is actually one I'm still working on, but trying to get, you know, Konerko's remembrances of that. But anyway, Davidson heard that Gellinger was a guy who maybe he could talk to, and Davidson had moved to Arizona that winter from California, and Gellinger was out in Arizona. It was like, you know, who can I find to go hit? And they, you know, went to White Sox headquarters at Camelback, and you know, they got together and worked. It was like a Monday, Wednesday, Friday thing, and they work a couple hours a day. And Gellinger said, you know, he had a good natural swing that most people do. You know, you put a bat in a little kid's hand and they swing, and usually it's the right way to do it. It's kind of a natural motion and thing for a body to do, basically, for a person to do. But he had gotten some advice, and you know, good and bad or whatever, he wasn't processing it the right way. So he had some mechanical flaws with his swing where, you know, he wasn't letting it be natural anymore. And you know, they talked over the course of the 2015-2016 off season, and you know, Davidson really responded for some reason to what Gellinger was telling him, and had the fortunate spring training where he you know, made the team, or did not make the team, but hit really well in spring training. Struggled a little bit when he went back to, you know, they didn't put him on the roster. Struggled when he went to Charlotte for a while, but not so long that he got in a huge slump and Davidson started hit again. And he put together a really good season in, I guess this would be 2015. Come next spring, you know, the White Sox are ready to sort of, you know, they've given up Addison Reed. You know, they still want to make this trade work. So, you know, I think he made the team out of spring training, right? And it was his first or second game, and he breaks his foot on the foul ball. And, you know, I asked Davidson, you know, was that the low point because you had come so far and sort of resurrected things in the minors and you get your shot with the White Sox again? And he's like, no, that didn't bother me because it wasn't something that I could control. You know, I felt like hitting 200 2 years in a row, that was something I could control. I was really down on myself for that. But I was in a good mental place, even though I was, you know, had this opportunity taken away from me. So, you know, whatever he was working with Gellinger appeared to stick, because he, you know, I don't remember what he hit in spring training. I think it was pretty good, and you know, they've given him this job that's not quite full time, but he does. It's you know, the bad side platoon, and sometimes he'll play third if Frazier doesn't, and he's hit pretty well so far. And you know, it's not you know, he hasn't gotten off to the Abbasale start, and he doesn't play every single day, even though he probably should. But it's just a nice little story for the White Sox, and I think a great baseball, you know, overcoming, you know, we're not talking about like a disease or, you know, some sort of family tragedy or anything like that, but some pretty big baseball related bad news that Davidson got, and for a couple years, and then breaking his foot like that. And he's come out of it and appears to be a viable major league player and somebody that can be on a roster that maybe wins games. So I just think it's a really nice story that's sort of emerging, and hopefully I can do it justice when I finally write it.
That's really cool. I've heard Gellinger's name tossed around a few times, so much so, you know, when I was in Arizona, I talked to a lot of the young players who had come over from other organizations and just kind of asked what's different over here, essentially. And a lot of them brought up Gellinger. I remember I did a feature story on Nicky Delmonico, who said the same thing as Davidson said to you about working with Gellinger. And so I was like, well, I guess I got to talk to this Gellinger guy. And, you know, and being following the White Sox for as long as I had never heard of him. So if they've got someone, and now that I know this is his first year, I believe, as the minor league hitting instructor, and right, if they've got someone who can kind of work with guys like Davidson, who I agree his story is really interesting, and I definitely look forward to reading your piece on it, because I didn't go as far back as the Paul Konerko angle. You know, I didn't realize that Konerko gave a lot of credit to him for helping as well. It's really interesting just to see how he's able to work with guys and the credit that they give to him.
Because sometimes all it takes is finding the right mentality for some of these hitters. I mean, you hear about I'm trying to remember who the player was, but sometimes you hear a player talk about, oh, well, yeah, this one hitting coach told me to try to think about hitting the inside half of the ball, and then all of a sudden it unlocks their power. And whatever it is, what do you need to find to get at that natural talent? Because Davidson was a guy who was on everybody's top 100 list, and it was primarily because of his bat.
Right. And, you know, I don't as a guy who, you know, I was an AP stringer in the late 90s and, you know, worked for the Northwest Herald in the early 2000s and covered the team as like the backup beat guy and a columnist when they went to the World Series. And Gellinger was always around. He was a guy who was, you know, he was in the media guide. And I can't remember exactly what like some of his titles were, if he was like, I don't know if he was information systems. I don't know. It's something he's very computer oriented and looking at things that we all look at now, you know, heat maps and swing rate and swinging, you know, all that stuff and things I'm having trouble naming, but stuff that he's, you know, kind of been on the cutting edge of, and a guy who's held many different roles in the organization. And I, you know, the White Sox seem to be lucky to have him, you know, if Canerico vouches for him. And, you know, I asked Mike if there are any other Matt Davidson type stories, and he doesn't, you know, he hasn't been a guy that the organization has like, you know, like a horse whisperer sort of thing where it's like, well, if this guy's struggling, we got to send him to Gellinger, but maybe they should, you know, it's, it's just one of those things where if it's kind of worked out, he's helped the guy. So, you know, I don't think it's a regular thing, but, you know, they might want to think about making it a regular thing if they have another Davidson type situation coming up.
Yeah, him and Steverson seem to have a really good relationship too, which I know is important because the White Sox have struggled to find, you know, a consistent message from the hitting side of the ball throughout their minor league system. But I know, you know, during the offseason, I guess they both live in Arizona. So, like the Davidson situation that you mentioned, guys want to get extra work and they come down. And he, you know, Gellinger and Steverson are talking all the time. So the message seems to be pretty clear throughout the organization from a hitting perspective, which I don't think was always the case.
Right. And this goes back to sort of what we were talking about before with Renteria and the value that just reminding players of things that they already know and kind of clearing their head of the clutter of the different advice that they get that sort of piles up like plaque, you know, and doesn't really, you know, they can't really use it anymore. You know, they can't, it's almost like a straitjacket or a binding of some kind where they have all these layers and, you know, Randy from A Christmas Story when he goes out with 80 layers of coats on, you know, and he falls down. So I think of some strange analogies, don't I? But it's, you know, just sort of removing some of those layers and, you know, and maybe putting one or two back that are useful and just, you know, seeking clarity, just, you know, clearness of thought and a peace of mind and all that stuff. It's, you know, the human brain is a funny organ.
And it's a weird sport where it's not like effort is necessarily going to translate to results and sometimes quite the opposite. You know, if you're trying too hard, it's probably going to mess with your pitch recognition and then just relaxing and waiting to attack your pitch. And that was something Davidson was talking about in terms of, you know, just learning what to lay off and what not to. What's I was looking at just now, I mean, obviously these are tiny samples, but he got off to that great start, but his strikeout to walk ratio was 17-1, which was terrible. And he's cooled off recently, but his strikeout to walk ratio has normalized considerably during that span where it's 6-4, which is a lot more, you know, if a hitter could do that, have a, you know, a 3-2 strikeout to walk ratio, that's a very sustainable rate. So hopefully he can keep the good and jettison the bad a little bit because he was, you know, if you're giving him 450 plate appearances a year, that could be part of a really good team. I know we're coming up on an hour, yes. And I'm sure we could do this all day. I do want to make sure that we do our Catbird Speaks tradition of slamming the Royals a little bit. Like we have to. Right? And it's, you know, and at least we've got results to back it up right now. They're getting killed. And Dave, you got front row seats. What's going on?
I do. I have a good view of how bad the Royals have been. It's, you know, finally Eric Hosmer has put some hits together, but the people who watch really, really closely are like, eh, they're all on the ground. You know, he's just finding holes. And so, you know, he's not driving the ball like maybe he should. And there's a guy that's been – I don't want to say it's all Hosmer's fault, but it largely is. I mean, he's been kind of slumping here for an entire year, and I don't know if it's a case of him – you know, getting jitters because free agency is coming up, but you know, the Royals. Before the season, I had become not a fan or anything like that, but respectful of what they were doing, and you know, being a team that is more than the sum of the parts and all that stuff, and a believer in Ned Yost as a leader of men, if not you know, a saber raconteur, certainly. But you know, they don't have. You know, the bullpen is weaker up until Herrera. The starting pitching, other than Vargas, has been and Kennedy for the most part has been really bad. And you know, Alex Gordon is still not hitting. Kane has been fine actually, but Hosmer's been bad. Moustakas has been meh. You know, Sal Perez has been his usual self, which is, you know, all kinds of hidden value, but. Not necessarily, you know, he's not Carlton Fisk at the plate in 83, you know, he's back there. And Alcides Escobar has been terrible, and they haven't gotten anything out of Mondesi or second base. So they're just, you know, it's almost like, you know, they won the World Series, and they went to the World Series 2 years in a row. And so it's not a fluke. You know, you can't say that it's a fluke, but still, it's a, like all those things that you didn't really like or get about the Royals before. It's almost like, ah, now, you know, 4 years later, it's finally coming true. They did suck all along. You know?
Well, yeah, that's like what I was I think we talked about this off the air for a minute where I was like, yeah, like their rotation's not great and their offense is, you know, it's okay. They got a lot of okay hitters, but I don't really see it. And so now it's like, well, it's not that different, but I guess the tipping point, maybe it's like instead of being really, really high probability to be half a run better than your opponent every game, it's now really, really high probability of being half a run worse than your opponent every game, and it's just working out this way. But, you know, Alex Gordon was a guy that I was really hoping the White Sox would sign coming into 2016, and now it's looking like, well, maybe he's just done. Brandon Moss might also be done as opposed to Kendrys Morales, who was their scrap heap signing that really worked out. I guess, is it just that they had that thin margin for error and now it's gone and they traded away their reinforcements to bolster that World Series team?
That was the next thing I was going to mention, I think, was sort of the thin margin for error that, you know, being a World Series team and being a dominant team and being a really good team, you know, it takes – and like I said before, there are several big, huge things that are not happening. You know, we mentioned Gordon not hitting and Hosmer not hitting and so forth. These are huge issues. It's, you know, so it's not just a matter of, you know, being a little unlucky or, you know, things not turning around. They're definitely, they've got some huge flaws that I don't, that don't appear to be correctable as far as turning this season around. So, but you know, they still play. They, you know, actually they did in the off season, you mentioned bringing in, Moss, and they brought in Soler, who hasn't played until now because he's been hurt. They definitely knew that they were going to have some trouble with some spots in the rotation and maybe middle relief and some other spots. So they went and they tried to add some offense, and you know they haven't gotten it from those guys like Moss, and they haven't gotten it from the big bats of the past. So, I mean, that's been their last, or at least like as of a week ago, they were last in runs scored. So, I mean, that's the huge thing. And when you look at the inconsistency with the second base situation and Escobar, not only just hitting so awfully, but losing range a little bit every year and not being as good of a shortstop as he used to be. You know, the good things that the Royals were doing before, you know, there's a lot of the shine has been removed from that, and they just have too many players not hitting. I mean, it's, you know, Gordon can't, unless he's done, like you said, and I don't think that's what it is, unless there is an injury that has robbed him of something. And it could be, He's a great physical specimen, but I don't know if there if this is a holdover from the injuries of the last 2 years, or it's just he's gotten off to a bad start and is sort of in a Canerco like dive where he just goes off for weeks or months at a time. But you know, if Gordon isn't going to hit and if Hosmer isn't going to hit, they're not going to win, because those things that the Royals do well, that's not enough to carry you if you don't have some punch at some point in the lineup.
I saw today that there was a headline that of all the guys that are going to be going, that they might extend Alcides Escobar, which seems like the worst one to do at this point. But
Royals fans, the ones that I follow on Twitter, and there's some, I don't know if you guys have like any relationship at all with them. They're really good, smart baseball fans, and I suppose you could say that about every city, but you know, I really respect their opinion about things, and they can't believe it. They're like, you know, take me out back and shoot me if this is really going to happen. They don't, you know, they see, you know, Escobar is definitely being way beyond his most valuable point, and they wonder, well, you know, as the mishandling of Raul Mondesi, who was like supposed to be the short, you know, maybe the shortstop of the future, you know, have they screwed him up by bringing him up too soon to make the front office think that they need to keep Escobar around, because Mondesi's you can't salvage him now. So it's people are definitely worried about the direction that the team's going just based on this rumor. And I hope it's not true. I mean, he's a really nice guy and all, but you know, you've got to move on. You can't give him big time money when you're the Royals. And the Royals, that's one thing, you know, we're here to trash the Royals, but the ownership, David Glass and the other Glass, I forget his name, not George Glass, not Jan Brady's boyfriend, but
not Philip Glass.
Not Philip Glass.
Tanner Glass.
Nope. Not Philip Bailey, but Royals ownership, they've been spending money. They're in the middle or in the top 10 over the past couple years of payrolls. So they've been, I mean, and that's based on the economics of baseball, that's more than you can expect from the 30th market or whatever they are. So they've been, you know, they've had to spend money to kind of sustain this a little bit. And so the ownership will put some money into the payroll, but it's they should not put any more into Alcides Escobar. No.
There's sorry, Nick.
Go ahead, Colin.
Oh, no, I was just going to say there's only one Royals fan who I interact with on a regular basis, a guy I work with, and he's a fairly intellectual guy, and I don't know if his mindset is similar to the Royals fans that you hear from or see, Dave, but his mindset's basically to hell with all of them, trade them all except for Lorenzo Cain, because he has some – obviously he's got more tools than the rest of the guys, and also he's shown what his ceiling can be, or he's shown how good he can be at his peak, as opposed to the Hosmers or Moustakas or Escobars. Is like it's going to be tougher to part with Kane, I guess, maybe from an emotional standpoint, than it will be Hosmer or Moustakas or Escobar or even Herrera, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the way Hosmer's going right now, I don't know that you can trade him this deadline, and B, I don't know what his off-season free agency, you know, what I don't know what Boris, you know, the joke was $200 million for Hosmer at one point. I mean, you know, I don't know how you get 75. How do you get Brandon Belt money for Hosmer right now? Is he going to have to take a 1 year offer and wait for another year of free agency? You know, Moustakas is a guy I think you could probably afford more than Hosmer, but you know, if all things being great for Hosmer, but keeping Kane, I mean, it's interesting. He's got, you know, he's over 30 now, I think, isn't he 30? And maybe he's not that old. But
he's got the Dexter Fowler deal to point to. I mean, they're, you know, especially with his walk rate going up, you know, he's really controlling the zone this year. You know, if he becomes an on base. And he's a better defender in center than Fowler. I mean, he could make a – you know, he doesn't have as much pop, but he could make an argument to say, hey, I should be getting whatever – Fowler got, what, like 575 or 580 or something like that?
Yeah.
And granted, the Royals just gave that to to Kennedy, but maybe that's going to prevent them from retaining – Kane, or maybe they trade him and bring him back afterwards. I mean, that can happen. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the Royals have run out payrolls in this year and last year that are higher than anything the White Sox have ever done. So that's been there. I just wonder how much of it is too that you just, you know, they traded away Will Myers and they traded away Sean Manaea, and some of these guys were like, you know, you need at a certain point to develop a number three starter internally, or you need to develop a corner bat internally if you're really going to sustain success. And they may have, you know, and they got the ring for it, so, you know, great, but that may have been the choice they had to make.
You know, flags fly forever, as the podcast goes and as the phrase goes. So, I mean, I don't know that I would do anything different if I were them, but, you know, maybe this is, like you said, this is where the butcher's bill comes due, you know, for the for winning the championship and getting to the World Series the year before. You know, you can't just not pay for that, I guess, as an organization. It's one of those things where you have to sort of bite the bullet and maybe start over.
And because this is a White Sox podcast, I guess before we wrap up, are there any non-Moncada, because I feel like that's cheating. Are there any particular White Sox prospects that you're hoping to see in the majors this year that you just have a hunch about, where you say, you know, maybe you're a guy who's like, well, Carson Fulmer, I really think that guy's going to come up and be a solid starter this year, or do you have any pet prospects who are close to the majors, you think?
The truthful answer is I don't, and I'm just racking my brain right now to come up with something so I sound intelligent.
Like I'm a Ronaldo Lopez booster who's irrational about him. I think he's going to be up this year and kill it. But
he's no Nicky Delmonico,
right?
You know, I love the Nicky Delmonico story. I love his name is awesome. I love that his name, you know, that he's called Nicky. I love the Delmonico part because Delmonico is a cut of steak, and you got ribbies and RBIs and all that, and it's the puns would be great. I'm rooting for Matt Davidson to succeed, but so I don't know if he and Delmonico are somehow linked as far as playing time and all that, but potential playing time. But when they got Delmonico and he's turned things around or improved or whatever, I really liked that story too. So sort of hope that there's something comes to fruition with him. I don't know. Do they have any well, Courtney Hawkins is a lost cause, of course, at this point, but they got any good leadoff type guy? Well, is Moncada a leadoff guy, or is he a third in the order kind of guy? I'd love a good leadoff hitter.
I think he could arguably do both. I mean, he's a dude who's got a really good eye. He strikes out a lot, but I've been told that that's just because he swings like crazy hard. And he has a lot of power, but I think he looks more like a 20 to 25 homer guy. I don't know if he's ever going to have the walks for it, but Colin, I don't know just his term shape of his production. Do you think like a Bobby Abreu type shape of production is that crazy for me to hope for a guy like this?
That sounds reasonable because, I mean, Abreu stole a decent amount of bases during his peak too. It's interesting.
Like Dave's 20 to 25 homers.
Yeah. 2020 guy, right?
He was a 2040 guy some years, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's interesting to think about lineup placement. I'd never really thought of it from that mindset. It's obviously not something that's super important, but like, I don't know. Is he a two hitter probably in an ideal lineup, Moncada?
I mean, if he's a two hitter, I think your lineup's probably really good.
Yeah.
do you think of him as a two hitter, like that you're supposed to put your best hitter second?
Yeah, that's kind of the mindset that I take with it.
I don't know how many walks he's going to get in the majors, but he's definitely got the talent to hit for a high average, draw some walks, and hit for power, and he's a burner. So, you know, you could say, all right, we'll just stomach the fact that he's going to hit some solo homers and just put him at leadoff and be really happy with it.
Here's a good irresponsible comp. How about Francisco Lindor? Can he be the White Sox Francisco Lindor?
I think he could, from the perspective of being like the transcendent middle infield face of the franchise, like those general attributes, but I mean, Lindor is an 8 defensive shortstop, and Mankata, I mean, he could probably survive at short if you threw him there, but he's a second baseman, and I don't think he still looks a little unnatural there at times, even though every now and then he'll just like flash a crazy throw or do something super athletic. But I don't, what I've heard is that he's not going to give you that elite defensive value. But if he could be, I mean, he's young enough and he's close enough that he could fill that role in a different way for the team, I think, possibly.
You know, now that I've had like five, we've been talking about this and my brain is a little more active with the White Sox prospects, I'll be interested to see if Zach Collins can do both, if he can be a catcher and be a good hitter, because that's really hard to do, especially over the long haul. I mean, even I wonder if we see sometimes with Buster Posey, you know, who's that, I mean, that's, you know, elite. I don't think anybody's expecting, I don't think they're expecting Zach Collins to be like Buster Posey, but it seems like the really great Buster Posey bat is tempered by having to play catcher and the consequences of that. And but, you know, even for a few years, just to see a really good hitting catcher who also is good behind the plate. And I don't know if Posey's one of the best and all that. And so I don't know if Collins is even like that, but just there's a guy. Zach Collins.
Yeah, no, Collins is fast. I know he's been throwing out base runners really well this year. Like people are trying to run on him and it's not working. And granted it's the minors, but I mean, Posey also has that component of like elite contact skills and elite receiving. And I mean, the walks are going to be there from Collins and the power is probably going to be there. And then if you can throw out runners, great. It's going to be really interesting because if he turns into, I think this is the second podcast in a row where I've tried to come up with a comp for a catcher and really, really struggled.
I've been thinking, what about like a Mike Napoli? Mike Napoli survived behind the plate for a few years, but was never a good defensive catcher, but he hit really well, and that made him even more valuable, and he was a pretty patient hitter, drew a lot of walks. So that's the guy who comes to my mind if we're making irresponsible comps.
I don't even think that's that irresponsible, and who knows what Napoli's career would have looked like if his hips didn't start to betray him. I mean, obviously he's still productive, but if he's a high walks, high power guy who can not hurt you behind the plate, I mean, that's a top 10 catcher in the majors, right?
You would think so.
So that could be cool. Dave, I don't want to take any more of your Sunday than you can spare. Is there anything you wanted to, I mean, Colin, unless you had any more questions you wanted to ask Dave, give Dave a chance to, promote, place to find him on Twitter and, any articles that you're, if anyone is listening to this who doesn't already follow you.
yeah, right. What good is this doing any of us? No, everybody knows this already. No, I'm kidding. No, this is fun. I'm really happy to be to be on here talking about the White Sox. It's you know, I told Nick, probably the White Sox and my kids and Star Wars are my favorite topics. So it's great just to talk, even if it's just us three and nobody hears this. I've had a really good time for an hour and a half and or whatever it is, an hour and 15 minutes. I'm at Answer Dave on Twitter, and that's free, and the humor there is free and not necessarily good, but it's free. And Baseball Prospectus, I think the stories that I write are free. We do. I'm an editor there, and I edit a lot of the fantasy stuff. And I'm supposed to be writing more than I have. It's just the workload has been – I've got a million excuses. I'm not going to go into it. But I've got the Davidson story. I'm working on – the Indians were just here in Kansas City where I'm based out of. So I'll have a Francisco Lindor story and a bullpen usage story that I'm working on. Andrew Miller, Cody Allen, and Terry Francona, he like gave me a – 10-minute dissertation on bullpen usage. That's really fascinating on a nerd level. He's like, I've really thought about this a lot, you know, can you tell? And it's, so it's good. I've got good stuff. I've just, I've got to get off the air here and write it. So, you know, let me go.
Yeah. Well, please, wait, let me go. if Jose Quintana were a Star Wars character, who would he be?
He's he wouldn't be Admiral Akbar. Excuse me, because I mean it's a trap. That's not good for a defense. You want to catch the ball.
And Akbar is such a demonstrative guy.
Right. He's very quiet and reserved and sort of lets his pitching do the talking for him. You know, I love asking players questions like this because I feel like it's I like to see who's clever and really sharp and thinking on their feet and that kind of thing. And I get asked the questions and I'm like, you know, maybe it isn't such a good idea to ask people questions like, you know, which Star Wars person would you be like? Because, you know, of course I'm coming up Quintana. I mean, he sort of looks like C-3PO a little bit, but C-3PO and the personalities are not the same. So that's no good. And he's not really a Chewie.
I could see him being a Yoda when he's older.
Right. A pitching coach Quintana, if you wanted to do that. Would be more like a Yoda. You know what? He's kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi-like.
That's what I was going to say. And I don't really know shit about Star Wars.
No, you know enough. You know enough shit about Star Wars. Just kind of confident in himself and wise, you know, if you listen to the advice. And stoic. Yeah, he just I can see him wearing a robe, you know, so he looks the part as well. I think Obi-Wan Kenobi is Quintana. Doesn't Quintana sound like a Jedi Master?
I mean,
Qui-Gon Jinn, Quintana, you know, it's I think we've answered the question. All we got to do is talk it out.
I think we got there.
Well, amazing. We will let you go, Dave. Again, I want to thank you, just as Nick did, for joining us today. This has been great, and hopefully we can do it again soon.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on, and thanks for talking about the White Sox. I'm glad somebody does.
All right.